So we're now at the fulcrum of the book, the middle point. And of course, the key verse in all of this is, "The one who curses you, I will curse." So you'll notice that God is going to hold all of these nations accountable for mistreating Judah or the nation of Israel while Judah is in unbelief. You see that? While Judah is in disobedience, God is still going to hold these nations accountable for mistreating her. And this is why I'm kind of bothered by this idea that we should not promote Israel, we should not support Israel. Look at how Israel is an unbelieving nation. Well, when you understand the structure of the book of Ezekiel, you understand that God still holds nations accountable for mistreating the nation of Israel, even while the nation of Israel is in disobedience. Do you see that? So Ezekiel starts with the nations to the east of Israel, Ammon, Moab, and Edom. There's what they look like on a map. Ammon rejoiced, chapter 25, verses 1 through 7, when Nebuchadnezzar came, because Ammon thought, we can expand our territory. So God says, I'm going to judge Ammon. Moab, now notice that these nations didn't even do anything. They just thought something against Israel. Moab said, chapter 28, verses 8 through 11, look, the house of Judah has become just like the other nations. They were happy when Nebuchadnezzar came. And God says, I'm going to judge Moab. And then Edom, all it says there in chapter 25, 12 through 14, is they took revenge on the house of Judah. So God says, I'm going to judge Edom. And then Ezekiel moves to the west, Philistia to the north, Tyre and Sidon to the south, Egypt. And in chapter 25, verses 5 through 17, he pronounces judgment on Philistia to the west, who tried to destroy Judah. And it's interesting that Philistia just went out of existence in the intertestamental period. So sometimes that's how God deals with nations. There's no cataclysm, they just disappear. They go out of existence. And then he moves to the north, to Tyre and Sidon in chapters 26 through 28. He deals with Tyre and Sidon together because they were in an alliance. And Tyre and Sidon thought to themselves that they could profit by Judah's demise. Without Jerusalem being available to secure overland trade routes, more products would have to be shipped from Tyre, which had a prosperous seaport, and so Ezekiel pronounces judgment on Tyre. Now, it's interesting, these other nations, he's only spent a few verses on, but Tyre gets three chapters. Chapter 26, 27, and 28, and why does Tyre get three chapters of judgment? Because if you go to Ezekiel 28, 12 through 17, you see a cherub, who is an angel, motivating the king of Tyre. And I believe Ezekiel 28, 12 through 17 is a description of Satan's fall. It's sort of a Matthew 16, 23, 22, 23 moment where Peter makes a statement and Jesus addresses the force behind Peter making the statement. And he says, get behind me who? Get behind me Satan. See, that's what Ezekiel's doing here. He's making a prophecy against the king of Tyre, but then he sees the angelic being that's motivating Tyre. And in the process, he gives a description of Satan's fall, how Satan was once Lucifer and became Satan. The prophet Isaiah, chapter 14, 12 through 15, does basically the same thing, in my estimation. Then he moves to the nation to the south, which is Egypt, and he devotes four chapters to Egypt. Why is that? Because Egypt has a track record with Israel. It was in Egypt that the nation spent 400 years of captivity. And it looks like, when you look at Ezekiel 29:16, and earlier, Ezekiel 17, verse 15, that they looked at Egypt as sort of something that they could rely on besides God. And God says, you can't rely upon Egypt. And he gives about seven oracles here against Egypt. And we know there are seven oracles because it says the word of the Lord came to me in chapter 29, verse 1 and verse 17, chapter 30, verse 1 and verse 20, chapter 31, verse 1, chapter 32, verse 1, and also verse 17. And that sort of completes the fulcrum of the book, chapters 25 through 32. And if you look at Ezekiel 33 and verse 21, now Ezekiel gets word that Nebuchadnezzar hasn't just started the job, he's finished the job. He started the job in 588, the job's finished in 586. The temple is gone. The city is destroyed. No doubt these exiles, once they receive word of this, are totally dejected. Instead of false optimism, now they're filled with false pessimism. And so Ezekiel then starts the final third, if you will, of his ministry, chapters 33 through 48, which deals with not the judgment upon Judah, but the restoration of Judah. So now we're in the final third of the book, which is symmetrical to chapters 1 through 24. Everything that happened in chapters 1 through 24 in terms of judgment is reversed in chapters 33 through 48. So he receives news of Jerusalem's destruction, verse 21 of chapter 33. His judgment, his dumbness is removed. Chapter 33, verse 22. See, in the first part of the book, he could only talk of judgment when God opened his mouth. That's how people knew that when Ezekiel spoke, it had to be of God. But now that dumbness is removed, and because he's changing subjects. He's no longer dealing with judgment on Judah. He's dealing with prophecies of restoration. And in chapter 33, Ezekiel is recommissioned by God. The same language in Ezekiel 3, verses 17 through 19, about his responsibilities as a watchman on the wall to declare everything that God has said. The same thing is repeated in chapter 33, verses 7 through 9, because now he's being recommissioned by God. It's still a very high level of the standard he had to meet in terms of declaring everything God said. But this time he's going to be preaching restoration instead of destruction. So Ezekiel is actually commissioned two times in this book as a watchman on the wall. Chapter 3 and chapter 33. And so he moves into his prophecies in chapter 34. And he talks about the current shepherds of the nation who were feeding themselves while the flock remained sick. This is the indictment of the modern day pastor whose, you know, bank account is exploding with money because he's preaching prosperity gospel to the people while the people are poverty stricken. It's basically how God feels about shepherds that don't feed the flock but fleece the flock. I'm glad we don't have any of those today. Amen. It's amazing how applicable this is. And he says, you know, all of these shepherds, they're feeding themselves at the expense of the flock, but one day God is going to raise up a selfless shepherd. And of course we think of Jesus who would lay down his life for the sheep and that kind of thing, John chapter 10. But if you look very carefully at chapter 34 and verse 23, he says, I will set over them one shepherd, my servant who? David. And he will feed them. He will feed them himself and be their shepherd. So people look at that and they say, well, that just refers to Jesus there. That's referring to David's greater son, Jesus Christ. Over in chapter 37, verse 24, there's another reference to David. So who is David? Is David David or is David Jesus? Now, I'm the guy that got up in front of you and said Babylon is Babylon, right? So I think David means David.